One thing is the eternal learning curve. The more you know, the more you realize you have more to learn.
At the end of the day, you can be as good as gold, but if you don't have passion for wine, no matter how good you are, it isn't going to work.
And Mother Nature is your partner all the way until it's done.
Whereas the U.S., you go into a big grocery store and you have 2,000 different glass bottles full of wine.
My father told me, never work for money. Work to accomplish something. Making money is the result of doing something right.
The bottom line is, it's all about the soil.
Well, the results are really the benefit of our doing our homework.
What makes winemaking so interesting and fascinating is that every single year it's been different.
There was definitely a sense that we were all sort of in a pioneering endeavor. It was fun.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 122. This week we feature Raymond Vineyard winemaker Stephanie Putnam. We had the pleasure of doing a tasting with Stephanie in the famous Red Room at Raymond Vineyards. And rather than do the usual interview, we simply recorded the tasting. See what you think. And we're here with Stephanie Putnam, winemaker for Raymond Vineyards, and we're going to be doing a tasting, so it'll be a bit of a different piece for us, where our listeners could just sort of take in the atmosphere while we go through this taste in the incredible Red Room at Raymond.
All right, so you've already had our whites. Now we're going to work through our reds, and we're going to start off on the left with our 2011 Reserve Merlot. And I think that out of all of the wines, this is probably one that shows the most true terroir, because it comes mostly from our estate in Rutherford. And so everything that you think about in terms of Rutherford Cab, or you've heard about Rutherford Cab, where it's got a lot of meatiness and firm tannins and a lot of structure, that terroir transcends across varietals. It's not just about Cabernet, it's the Merlot. And so this Merlot drinks more like a Cabernet. In fact, I've done it, tasted people on it blind, and they've mistaken it for a Cabernet because it is so big and so meaty. And if you're looking for a fruity Merlot, this is not it. That's what I always tell everyone. If you want something fruity, go somewhere else. But our Merlot does drink more like a Cabernet. The soils here are a little heavier, have a little bit more of a clay influence, and that heavier soil with a little bit more of that clay influence will delay ripening, which I think is very crucial because Rutherford is very warm. So it helps even out more the extremes of the day. So we're able to get our Merlot ripe without a lot of the alcohol or the heat. And that, so you're really picking up on what the true Rutherford character is. That minerality, that roasted coffee, the firmer tannins.
Is this a standalone Merlot? Or I'm sorry, was this what you used for? I'm assuming it's a standalone.
I do actually blend in a small amount of Cabernet, but not for the reason that you would expect. Most people think that you would blend in the Cabernet to make it bigger, but because Merlot is a varietal, is a very supple grape, traditionally, especially around here, not a grape that has a lot of tannins. And so when we have our Merlot with all that tannin and all that structure, I found that it misses something in the middle. Mm-hmm. So I blend in a little bit of Cabernet to kind of round out and give it a little bit more of that mid-palate presence, but I don't want to lose the personality of our Merlot. So it's just enough to round it out, but not enough to make it heavier. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to make it more balanced.
Sure. It's very nice. I am one of those people who love Merlot. In fact, that's kind of what led me down the path. But definitely full-bodied. There's my word, full-bodied.
Full body is the one that you use a lot. But yeah, I mean, if you were to drink that blind, would you guess it was a Merlot?
Here's the honest truth. I can't say for two reasons, because I've caught myself in blind tastings a number of times. When I tasted it, I clearly identified it as a Merlot in my head. Mm-hmm. I made that connection. Blind, and depending on what I'm comparing it to, I don't trust myself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no,
I can't say that. I'm usually reasonable at identifying varietals.
Right.
Reasonable. I don't consider myself a person with a tremendous palate. I just one who knows what I like.
And there's a nice richness to it. but a lot more tins, I think, than a normal Napa Valley Merlot would have.
And it's Rutherford, you say, right?
Yes. So the next wine, which is our 2011 Reserve Cabernet, this is a wine that Raymond has been doing, you know, since the beginning. And this is actually our flagship wine, our flagship Cabernet. And actually the reason that I'm at Raymond today. So when I started out in the industry, without dating myself too much, it was a while ago, and I was at another winery, and we were competing, similar price points, similar scores, similar production level. And so Raymond was really the first one that I ever benchmarked myself against. Mm-hmm. And when I learned in 2009 that John Charles had purchased the property, you know, I really felt strongly about coming here. Because by that point in time, Raymond was still making great, solid wines. But we weren't the new kid on the block anymore, and so people tended to forget about you. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to be part of, like, you know, that, the, you know, what we call the renaissance of Raymond. Just, you know, the evolution of the wines, the evolution of the visitor experience. And so we've come a long way in 4 years. I mean, a huge... And the traffic has increased sevenfold. Mm-hmm. We're getting a lot of great scores, and so people are really starting to recognize a lot of the work that we've done behind the scenes.
Seem to have a better retail presence, too, these days, from what I've seen. Maybe it's just my imagination.
We do have a much better retail presence. Our sales force is dedicated to getting our wines out there. I think the retail presence is also helped by the fact that we've really worked on our visitor experience, and more people are talking about Raymond. Therefore, in the retail, they're going to say, oh, wow, they're asking about Raymond. We're getting better press regarding the wines or the experiences here. So then all those things kind of factor in to it.
Doesn't hurt when you taste in a room like this, does it?
No. No. I've met people outside, you know, when I go around to the different parts of the country presenting wines, and they, I talk about the red room, I'm like, oh, I think I've been there. I'm like, if you think you've been there, you haven't been there. Because you should. It should be an instantaneous, oh my God, I've been there.
It is an experience. I remember the very first time we came in here. I forgot how many years ago it was. Well, I guess three, right? Was that the first time you did the Napa Grass?
Yes.
Napa Grass was 3 years ago, yeah.
And I remember the two guys playing in the corner who mm-hmm. looked really
John's
cool.
Brother. Or John's brothers.
Yes.
Yeah. And they'll be back. The whole atmosphere of the place was like, well, let's just stay here all night.
There were some really, people who wanted to do that.
I'm sure they did. Hide behind the sofa. Yeah, I could sneak in back there. But it had just such a great atmosphere. And, of course, the wine is flowing. But it was comfortable. It was relaxed. There was no tension. And you really had a chance to taste and just enjoy yourself, which was great. And that's what a tasting experience should be. Not having to think too much.
Yes. Well, our Reserve Cab comes from a mix of our estate vineyards here in Rutherford and St. Helena, and then also some contracted vineyards throughout mm-hmm. Napa, from as far north as Calistoga all the way down south to Coombsville. And so that range of appellations that goes into our blend is what gives it more that the layers of flavor. So you're going to get more of that fruit pop from Calistoga with more of the texture-driven wines of Coombsville, plus, you know, our home base of Rutherford and St. Helena. And we do all of the things that a ultra expensive wine would do, but we don't necessarily charge that same high end pricing. Because when I started here, I had some pretty firm ideas on how a Napa Valley Cabernet should be treated. And so we brought on a lot of things. And now everything that we do is all the wines, all Napa Valley grapes, Merlot and Cab are all individually, you know, they berry sorted. Everything does extended maceration depending on the vintage. It's not a recipe, so, you know, I learned that some vineyards do better with longer macerations, others do better with a shorter maceration. It's not a recipe. It's not like, all right, after day 28 we'll press.
Yeah.
It's all small lot fermentation, because I think when the tank is too big you kind of cook out the complexity, and it's also an unfiltered wine. And so we really treat it like an ultra expensive or an ultra luxury wine. Mm-hmm. Because I think that winemaking is about a luxurious experience, and so for me, that's what I want to translate into the wine itself.
What was it sell for? Do you remember?
Way too cheap. when I Most of the sales guys hate me because I usually say, we need to raise the price, we need to raise the price, we need to raise the price. And they don't want to, because then you lose shelf space or a restaurant list. But at the end of the day, I think if your wine is too inexpensive compared to your competition, then people don't take you seriously.
Sure.
Right. And we want to be, I want our wine to be taken seriously. So you almost need to increase it just for that marketing perception.
Well, there's the other side of the coin, and that is, I've got a secret. This was pretty cool, you know,
yeah.
You tell your friends, and that's another way to, because there are certain wines out there that I consider falling right into that category that are, you know, some people may go, oh, I'd rather buy the more expensive, or looking at something like that. It's like, well, this is really good. So you don't recall what the price is, though?
It should be...
It's around 40.
Yeah.
I have the SRPs on the USB.
Great.
And tasting notes of all
okay.
the wines on a USB
Great.
For you.
Thank you.
But it's 40.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll, it's, you know, retail price will vary on the shelf, but
yeah.
our suggested retail is around 40. It's never going to be a $100 bottle of wine. You know, that's where our generations comes into, mm-hmm. but... I think when we started, we were closer to 20-ish, 23-ish. And,
mm-hmm.
and as a Napa Valley Cabernet, you're just not going to be taken seriously at that
yeah.
price point.
Well, it's nice that you give your buyers value. We appreciate that very much.
So we have the, is it the 2009?
2009 St. Helena, 2010 Rutherford.
Okay, so the 2009 St. Helena Cab. 2010 Rutherford Cab, and these are part of our district collection. So when we were in the Rutherford room
mm-hmm.
and you were looking at the different soils, so these wines are 100% Cabernet. Our reserve Cab is Cab blended with the other traditional Merlot, Cab Franc varietals. But these are 100% Cabernet because you're trying to show the personality of that appellation. Blending in other varietals, I feel somewhat... then you're starting to manipulate what you think the taste of that terroir is. And what we're trying to do here is show you what we think that appellation is all about. So the St. Helena, for me, much warmer climate. St. Helena is sometimes actually hotter than Calistoga because it's the narrowest part of the valley, so you get a lot of reflective heat. And where these vineyards are located are on the west side of St. Helena. Very sandy soils, not a lot of water-holding capacity. One vineyard that we get fruit from, I think it's 10 acres. It takes them over 7 days to water 10 acres of vineyard.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's because you only can water 7 rows at a time. And so because the soil, it's a very hot climate, you've got very sandy soils without a lot of water holding capacity, you get a lot of ripeness. And when you get a lot of ripeness, you get a lot of sweetness.
Mm.
And so St. Helena, for me, is, you know, very ripe, red fruit-driven wine, a lot of fresh raspberries and strawberries, and a lot of sweeter tannins. The wine is still big, but it's more that sweeter tannin.
Mm.
So for me, it's a great counterpoint to Rutherford. So it's, for me, it's more of a feminine wine. And I started calling that a feminine wine when I used to do tours for people. I would ask for a show of hands. Who preferred St. Helena? Who preferred Rutherford? And inevitably, women would raise their hand on the St. Helena, and the men would raise their hand on the Rutherford. And I think it has to do with when you're picking a wine out, you think about, what am I going to eat with it? And I think that men think barbecue, and women think something more like a you know, a chicken or a pasta or something like that. So I think it goes along with what you like to eat and with what you like to cook, and that's why I think there was that gravitation. But it was almost always women liked St. Helena and the men liked Rutherford. So that's where I came up with a feminine and masculine kind of point, counterpoint.
As long as you tell them after the fact. You know, don't want to be giving it away. Actually, I like that a lot.
And St. Helena, it's a beautiful wine. It
yes,
really is.
Yes. And an amazing finish. I mean, that just stays really nicely right on your palate.
So we've already had the St. Helena Cab. Now we're going to go to the Rutherford, and they're, again, nice to kind of do the point and counterpoint. St. Helena was a sweeter tannin. Rutherford, just like when I was talking about the Merlot, where you're going to have more firmer tannins, more structure, more of a meatiness. For me, I call it more of a brooding Cabernet. You know, so there's some minerality. There's the roasted coffee is also a common descriptor for, you know, Rutherford cabs. You know, it's a bigger wine. It's more intense tannins. It's definitely, you know, you think barbecue or think, you know, big, juicy filet mignon.
Meat.
Yeah.
See, I'm leaning towards the St. Helena. How funny is that?
Well, it still is a big wine.
It is, yeah.
You know, but you're also thinking about maybe what you want to cook with it, right. Or...
Or just crawl into a corner with the bottle all by myself and, you know.
Not with the bag over the bottle.
That Absolutely not. No way.
That's very, what movie was that? Sideways.
Oh, Sideways?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. There's a lot of moments like that in that movie.
Yeah, and there's also a vintage difference, 2009 versus 2010. Mm-hmm. 2009 was more of a, more of a supple, kind of elegant year. 2010 was a bigger year with chewier tannins, more structure-driven wines. So it's also a vintage thing.
I seem to be attached to 9, I'm finding all of a sudden, Lane. I don't know why.
I do love 9 as a vintage. I really do.
That's as objective as I can be, because after a while, I don't make notes about what I drink. I just simply drink it and I enjoy it. But after a while, I started noting, oh my gosh, these are 2009s, and I've had plenty of 10s in there too, but that starts sticking in your head going, well, okay, maybe this means something, you know, that this really is that vintage for me, you know, like certain other ones. Don't know.
Yeah, 92, 95, 2002. Those were some of my favorite vintages for different reasons. But yeah, I was never a huge fan of 97.
Oh, you said 2002, huh? Mm-hmm. Those three bottles of 2002 are missing from the wall.
Oh, well, now we know where they went.
From the library wall, so... It was
Oops.
A good year.
Oops.
It was a good year.
What are your thoughts on 2012?
I think 2012 is going to live up to everyone's expectations. Because sometimes, like with some vintages, like 97 was a vintage of the decade. And then 99 came along, and then people had to call it the vintage of the century because they'd already called 97 the vintage of the decade. And I've...
had nowhere else to go from there.
Exactly. Well, and really, I mean, in 2000 was the next century. So they could get away with calling it a vintage. And for me, 99 was always nice, but it was a very tight vintage. And even now, the wines aren't really coming out of their shell. So while I thought 99 was a nice vintage, I don't think it was a vintage of the decade or of the century. Cause to me, it's still so tight. And I've tasted enough 99s at different places to feel that is pretty true, and the wines are just very tight.
Do you ever make notes or just kind of keep that in your head?
Sometimes I'll make notes. It depends on where I am and who I'm with as to whether or not I'll take notes.
Sure, at a nice dinner, you don't want to pull out a pad and say, excuse me one moment. But
right, yeah, you know. but now it's quite common to pull out your phone and take a picture
all the time.
Of the wine, and we have done that. I've done that.
Well, it's a great way for pieing, because the worst thing you can do is leave a restaurant and...
What was that bottle of wine? Yeah.
Yeah, the worst thing. And then what was the vintage? So, yeah. Interesting. I'm going towards the St. Helena. A couple of times I tried it while we chatted.
Yeah, it's probably...
And that's not to say I take anything away.
Right. They're both great vintages. They're just different. I mean, because the truth is there really aren't any bad vintages in Northern California. I mean, we're very blessed. I mean, what we call a bad vintage, Europe would be hailing as a fantastic year. So we just don't have the extremes that they do.
Right.
And so we get ultra picky about what we like about a certain vintage. And so I think 09 and 10 are great, but they're great in their own unique aspects.
Sure.
10 is more of a muscular vintage overall. You know, more, you know, bigger tannins, more structure. Whereas, you know, like 11 is going to be what I call more of a European vintage, because it truly was more of a European vintage. But there you're going to have wines that are softer, not as fruit forward. 12, going back to your question, is definitely going to be a wine, I think, that lives up to everyone's expectations. It seems to be a vintage. It has a lot of velvet, a lot of sweeter fruit. You know, a lot of great ripeness, but not over-the-top ripeness.
Are you doing a 12 for Premier?
Yes, we are.
I think there's going to be a lot of anticipation about
The 12 vintage, because this will really be the first time I think a lot of people have, especially the trade, will have seen what people can do with the 2012 vintage. Mm-hmm. So I it'll be interesting to see what happens with Premier and how, what the response is with the trade in terms of what they're willing to spend on cases of wine.
I think that's going to be really interesting, and what the numbers come out to be in the end.
Because I think last year, almost everyone poured some 2011, and I think there were some great responses, but I think people were also trying to hesitate because they were waiting for the 12s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would go along with that. Cool.
So the last wine is our 2010 Generations that we just released a couple of weeks ago. And Generations is a wine that is a tribute to the Raymond family legacy within Napa Valley. When the Raymond family can actually trace their winemaking legacy five generations back to the late 1800s with the Barringer family. Mm-hmm. And so they truly are one of the Napa Valley pioneers, if you will, because they've been here since the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. But they didn't start their own winery until Barringer sold to Nestle, and then they took their portion of the sale and established Raymond in 1971. So this wine is also 100% Cabernet, mm-hmm. and it is our vision of what we think or what we'd like Napa Valley Cabernet to be. You know, people expect Napa Valley Cabernet to be a big wine, big tannins, a lot of powerful fruit, but at the same time, I think there's a lot to be said for subtleties and elegance mm-hmm. and sophistication to a wine where it's not pow in your face. It has a lot of layers and depth to it. It's a wine that keeps giving and evolving. It's not in your face. Just because it's not in your face doesn't mean that it doesn't have a lot of layers and complexity. It's a wine that keeps giving, and so it's got a little bit more of a feminine touch.
It's very good. I do see it as very bold. I don't see as much the feminine side myself if I were to compare it to Santa Elena, but just sits real nicely.
But there, there's some nice velvet to the mid palate, and again, part of that is again the vintage. Same thing as the 2009 Generations of 2010. Hmm. If you were to taste the 09, then you would see more of that silk and velvet. But that does have some really nice silk on the entry for me. Some creaminess mm-hmm. to it with the Generations.
I definitely see the silk for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. This is the fun thing about doing this kind of tasting, is just kind of go backwards then and start, see if what you really felt the first time you heard it was...
Sure.
Or you tasted it was valid.
Well, and the wine also evolves in the glass, too.
Right.
And we just poured these wines.
So there's going to be a lot of change as time goes on. As you sit here for a while, they would get a little bit different.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would open up more, and you would see more of the fresher fruits.
Do you ever find that a challenge in a tasting when they haven't opened, if you don't have the opportunity to really get them air for a while?
It can be tough, and if I know, some vintages tend to need a little bit more time opening up. I think 2010 is a vintage that needs a little bit more time. I try and ask them to decant it if possible. Some vintages don't need that, and they're just fresh right out of the glass. Mm-hmm. So if possible, I do try and ask that when I can. It's not always... available.
Sure.
Depending on what you're doing and how many people you're doing it for. I'm a Napa Cab girl. I grew up on wines and Napa Cab. Grew up in San Francisco. So my parents used to bring me up here wine tasting. I was drinking wine when I was probably 12. I used to color coordinate my grape juice with this is a true story. So whatever, I could have the wine, or I would color coordinate my grape juice. If it was my parents were drinking a Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc, then I would have white Concord grape juice, and otherwise, then I would have the regular grape juice. And my dad would always ask me what I thought of that particular glass of wine or glass of grape juice or what I thought of the vintage. I always said the same thing: "Ooh, it's fruity," because I was 12. That's all you can say. But I even had my own decanter. So when my parents would drink an older wine and they would decant it, I had my own Baccarat crystal decanter for the grape juice.
I think you're probably the only person I could say I've ever met who had a Baccarat. Wow, that's amazing. You were pretty well doomed then to be a winemaker, I think. It was in the cards.
I was conditioned, yeah. No, I mean, I used to have 3-course meals when I was a kid. And it was just because my parents both grew up, you know, relatively poor. And, you know, they eloped and they bought all of their own china and they bought all of their own silver and all of their own crystal. So they decided that if we bought it and it's good enough for company, it's good enough for us to use on a daily basis. Because, you know, they didn't believe in we're going to put it up in a pretty cabinet so everyone can look at it. But we're only going to take it out at Christmas and Thanksgiving. We used it all the time, and I hated it as a kid because then I would have to clean everything, wash everything by hand because it couldn't go because the china had a 24-karat gold leaf around the side, so it could only be hand-washed, and, of course, crystal could only be hand-washed. I hated it. I was convinced they had me because they needed a dishwasher for a child.
You have to serve a purpose.
I'm pretty sure that was their goal in life. Like, we need a dishwasher.
Sure. Since you don't live out east or in the Midwest, that would be a snow shoveler or a lawnmower.
There you go.
Instead, you're the, but I mean, to grow up with that appreciation for food and this concept of, you know, what blending might be, you know, that's pretty cool. And so when was it that you finally got, well, I shouldn't say serious, you're already serious.
I've always been very, very specific and focused on what I wanted to be. You know, like, you know, my dad put himself through college, and so, you know, from the time I was 8, what college you're going to go to, I was going to go to UC Berkeley. And for many years, I was going to be a neurosurgeon. Not just a doctor, not just a surgeon. It was going to be a neurosurgeon. And then I volunteered at some hospitals, and I empathized too much with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I would either be destroyed or I'd become someone that I didn't want to be.
Yeah.
So then I switched careers, and this is why I actually went to UC Davis. I wanted to be an FBI agent. See, again, very focused. Don't ask me how I went from my dad worked for the government, and so, you know, he could have made a gazillion dollars working in the private sector, but for him it was very important to work for the government, and so I kind of fell along that line. And I wanted to be an FBI agent. I went to Davis, took a couple classes in poli-sci, and it's really not me. Mm. I would have killed myself playing the political game. It's just not me.
Sure.
And at the same time, I was doing research into, you know, what were the qualifications. And at the time this existed, there was a height requirement. And you had to be 5'2". And I'm not even 5 foot.
Wow. I didn't notice that.
I didn't.
See, well, I'm wearing clogs, which have like a little heel on
them. Oh, that made all the difference in the world.
And my hair, it certainly helps.
That's a good inch or two.
Absolutely. Right. You know, and so, you know, when you're 18, you're as tall as you're going to get.
Pretty,
it's really
generally
not,
speaking, pretty much, right.
Not going to get any better. So I decided that I was at Davis at the time with my parents' background and training in terms of wine and food, and I grew up with that appreciation. I took a class at Davis in just, you know, general winemaking, and I loved it. I've never looked back.
Stephanie, just for our listeners, if they want to find out about Raymond and maybe a little bit about you online, how would they do that?
Go to www.raymondvineyards.com.
Great. Thank you for this tasting. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Learn more at raymondvineyards.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2014.